So I'm very excited to be back, and I'm in 374, so do come along and have a chat, and I'll probably chase some of you guys down as well. The interesting thing is, the first time I ever came to Perimeter in May 2013, I gave a very similar talk with a very similar title about testing gravity using various astrophysical probes. So for those of you who are worried, you're going to hear the same talk that you heard 3 years ago and several follow-ups on. It's a completely different theory. For the first time, we've been able to test more of these higher derivative theories, so it's going to be a completely new talk, although some of the probes will be the same. So I'll start off, for those of you who don't work on modified gravity, and I know there are a couple in the room who do, why do I study alternative theories of gravity? What motivates me to do this? So one reason is the first one, they are potential dark energy candidates. They can explain the cosmic acceleration. Another reason is more of a completeness reason. General relativity has only been tested in the solar system and a few isolated semi-relativistic systems. And finally, there's a point which I think people don't make as often as they should, which is the last one. And the study of alternative theories of gravity has led to some great advances in scalar field theories, scalar tensor theories, and being able to write down new, healthy, consistent theories of scalars interacting with matter. And even if nothing comes out of the study of modified gravity, you don't know where else this is going to have applications. So I think it's...
So you don't get tested in cosmology?
No. If you look at these plots where you let, for example, the slip vary and the Poisson equation vary on cosmological scales, there is a very, very unconstrained region in parameter space. Although I will touch on that.
But you left one thing out, because now we know that there are gravitational waves, and so we have tested gravity.
The strong field regime, yes. I should say the last time I gave this talk was the day before they made the announcement. okay.
What about the dark matter problem?
I'm not going to touch on that at all. I'm interested in infrared modifications of gravity, which work on large cosmological scales. I will have very little to say about dark matter in this. Some of the theories I'm going to talk about can, if you tune them correctly, may be able to get rid of dark matter, but you're not going to solve problems like peaks in the CMB and things like that using this. So I stay away from dark matter. I don't need to do that, do I? Okay, so first point, dark energy. These are the Einstein equations. We've got the geometry on one side, and of course the geometry of the universe is sourced by what you put in it. And if you want to explain the cosmic acceleration, you have to add something called dark energy. You have to add a cosmological constant or some sort of quintessence model here. But this is really the simplest thing you can do. If you try and do anything else, so for example, fiddle around with this side, you can call it quintessence, you can call it an extra scalar, but what you're really doing is you're changing the theory of gravity, because you will have new degrees of freedom that interact with matter. So in some sense, if you want to study the acceleration of the universe, you don't have much of a choice. At some point, you're going to run into modified theories of gravity. Again, I touched on this earlier, completeness, and you're right, I should update this to include gravitational waves, which is the strong field regime. But prior to last month or so, we'd only tested gravity in the solar system, so the Newtonian and post-Newtonian predictions. We had binary pulsar tests, but again, these do not test the very fully covariant relativistic structure. It only probes the post-Newtonian structure. And another point which I think they're moving at speeds V over Cs of order 0.1, so V squared over C squared is 10 to the minus 2. So it's still a good expansion to use post-Newtonian. You're not going to the full order. I think a point that's quite often not made is that if you really want to test your theory of gravity, you need other predictions. You need other theories of gravity to provide differing predictions, so you've actually got something to test against. And this is quite a good motivator as well. So let me touch briefly on what local tests of gravity actually mean. And the example I like to use is probably the most famous and in some sense the simplest, and that is light bending by the sun using the Cassini probe. So one of the great predictions of general relativity is if I send light past the sun, it won't move in a straight line, it'll bend by some angle. The Cassini satellite, which orbits Saturn, measures this angle, and so you can test gravity using that. In practice, I test the Newtonian line element, which looks like that. and I parameterize.
Or is it the timing? I don't think it has a very good resolution, so it must be just the timing.
That I don't know. I know you can get a constraint on this thing gamma, which controls the lensing. Is it the timing? Okay, so it's a time delay. Okay. Either way, both those effects are parameterized by this number gamma, which quantifies deviation from general relativity. So this number is 1 in general relativity, and Cassini tells me that if I want to deviate from that, I can only do so at the level 10 to the minus 5. It's a very strong constraint. What does this mean for new theories of gravity? Well, before I start talking about modified gravity, let me tell you about the way I like to think about non-relativistic gravity in the solar system. And that is, if you want to make a prediction, you need a field equation. So you've got, in this case, the Newtonian potential being sourced by the local density. So that tells me the gravitational field of an object and how it's sourced. But you also need a force law. And this tells me how an object responds to this gravitational field. And in this case, it's just Newton's law. If I go to modified gravity, which generally includes an extra scalar degree of freedom, so a new scalar graviton, which I call phi. If I take a very generic theory of modified gravity, so the simplest classical ones like Brands-Dickey and things like that, I get another equation for the field. So it looks like that. It's another Poisson equation. And I get another force law, which is just the same thing as the Newtonian one, but there's some dimensionless coupling constant, which I call alpha. And because these two equations are the same, but multiplied by a factor of 2 alpha, the solutions are the same multiplied by a factor of 2 alpha. And so I'm going to get an additional force, the fifth force, as people call it, which is a factor of 2 alpha squared times the Newtonian force. And if I go and run through the calculation and calculate the time delay, what I find is that Cassini tells me this thing has to be less than 10 to the minus 5. So if I take a step back and think for a second, what I've done is I've introduced a new theory of gravity, which I would like to solve my cosmological constant problem for me, or cosmological problems in general. But I've got a number in this theory which I have to tune to be 5 orders of magnitude weaker or smaller than gravity. So for this reason, you typically end up with general relativity dominating on all scales, and this thing has very little to say about cosmology. But this is where modern theories come in, so theories that we've been playing with for the last 10, 15 years or so. And these include what are called screening mechanisms. So the idea with screening mechanisms is we want to use some sort of nonlinear effect, some nonlinear field equations for the new scalar that decouples solar system dynamics from the cosmological dynamics. So I want to have things look like general relativity in the solar system, but on cosmological scales, I want this scalar to somehow be important and potentially drive the acceleration. So the picture I like people to have in mind, it is in the solar system, your screens. So here things look like general relativity. Cosmology, you're unscreened, so my scalar drives my cosmic acceleration. And there's this interesting regime in the middle, this astrophysical regime, where things can be partially screened. And this is what I spend a lot of my time thinking about, ways we can test these theories using this regime. So I'm not going to write down general actions, because what I'm going to talk about is very general theory. So I'm just going to sketch how the screening mechanisms work. So I like to start by addressing what's the problem with modified gravity. Why doesn't it work? And the answer is, in the solar system, we don't need it. General relativity is enough. We did not need this extra scalar field. We did not need this extra Poisson equation. So if I want to somehow screen out the force locally, I have to fiddle around with this, because this was the problem. The problem was, if you recall, it looked exactly the same as GR, but we didn't need it. So one thing I can do is kill off the source. So my scalar is unsourced. And this gives what are called chameleon theories of gravity. I'm not going to talk about those today. I'm going to talk about the other mechanism, which is called the Weinstein mechanism. And this changes the structure of the kinetic term so that it changes the solution of the Poisson equation. So as an example, I can use what people call the cubic Galileon. So if I take the cubic Galileon model, I've got a Poisson equation like normal. I've got the part from GR or from the classical theories. I've still got a source, but I introduce this extra term here, this term which comes from funny higher derivative terms that you can put into the action. And if you integrate this once, you can actually find an algebraic equation for the ratio of the fifth to the Newtonian force, which I call x. And you see you get an algebraic equation like this. So this part comes from the Poisson equation. This part is the coupling to matter, the source term. And this is the new term here, which came in my new theory. So it's suppressed, it's enhanced by this factor RV over R. So RV is what people call the Weinstein radius. And if I'm on very small scales, so R much inside the Weinstein radius, I can ignore this first term, solve my algebraic equation, and I see that I get the same factor of 2 alpha squared, the same fifth force enhancement, but it's suppressed. It's suppressed by a factor R over RV to the 3/2. Now, of course, on larger scales, I'd like my scalar to actually do something. I'd like to have something cosmologically interesting. So on larger scales, this term is more important. I'm left back with the Poisson equation, and so I get fifth force enhancements.
Why is it the same factor? Is that an x squared?
Sorry?
Is it x squared? Is 2 alpha squared times R over RV?
This whole right hand.
Yeah, the whole right hand.
Yeah, there should be a factor of 2. There should be x over 2
so
alpha
it's like
squared.
Alpha sharp distance and alpha squared at
1. Yes, yeah, so actually, that's a typo there. Yeah, thank you.
In that expression, you find Weinstein radius is the integration constant?
No, it's because you're sourced. It's a combination of g, the object's mass, and the new scale, lambda, which appears. So this would appear in the new term in the cubic Galileon. So it's a combination of this, integrating this over the source. So it looks like RV cubed looks like GM over lambda.
It depends on phi itself. It basically depends on the amplitude of phi.
The radius, the Weinstein radius.
Yeah.
No.
Because there's no mass on the left-hand side. That's what we're
doing. It is an integration constant. The mass itself is an integration.
Okay.
I wouldn't say it's an integration constant because I mean all you're doing is this is some equation which is of the form. Can people see this?
Okay.
It's an equation which looks of the form d by dr of something looks like r squared rho. So if I think about integrating this, you get you essentially get the mass of the object. I wouldn't call that an integration constant because it's not. If you solve it, yeah, I guess if you solve it outside, then you can see it as an integration constant that you fix by the boundary. Yeah, okay. Okay. This is a picture I like for people to have in mind. Below the Weinstein radius, you're screened. Outside the Weinstein radius, you are unscreened. But how big is this Weinstein radius? What sort of numbers am I talking about? Typically, for theories of interest, you're talking 10 to the 2 parsecs or so. So this is big. This is for an object like the sun. So the sun has a Weinstein radius that's large enough to screen the entire solar system and much more. And it's exhibited in lots of different theories of gravity. So very famous, the DGP model. There are some reasons why people prefer looking at other theories these days. But interestingly, there's a very new general class of theories that people have been working on and they're very excited about, called beyond Horndesky theories. And I'm not going to say anything more about that, but if you're interested, ask me later. And it turns out that for the first time we've been able to probe some of these theories because the mechanism breaks partially in these theories. There are some effects which just aren't screened out, even though the Weinstein mechanism still works. And this is what I'm going to be talking about in this talk. Just so I always get this question, so just so you have the right picture in mind now, the way the breaking works in these theories is that if I'm outside an object, the theory is going to be screened, so the Weinstein mechanism works out here. I cannot test it using solar system tests, but inside objects of finite extent, things like the sun or the Earth or anything which has got a finite radius, you will see deviations from general relativity. Yep.
I'm going to be a crusty old curmudgeon and ask you, are you going to include time derivative terms?
I'm not going to include time derivative terms for beyond Horndesky theories. Even in the non-relativistic limit, okay. Maybe we can talk. You can talk about it afterwards. I don't.
So, I guess your point is much. That the initial value problem that breaks down when you follow this.
Oh, hang on. Are you talking about cosmological time derivatives?
No.
Local time derivatives.
Stuff
okay.
It has to do with astrophysics. I think that's where it's most
okay.
Famous.
I'd be interested to talk about that afterwards, yeah.
You go into all this trouble.
Yeah.
What's the problem with the cosmological constant?
people don't like the, but there is a cosmological constant problem in the sense that it is not technically natural. It's there's a lot of fine tuning there. And these theories, these higher derivative theories, have non-renormalization theorems attached to them. So these theories can be technically natural. As I said, I don't want to talk too much about that because I'm more interested in actually testing these. But this is the reason people find these things attractive. They are technically natural. And so for that reason, they're seen as viable alternatives to lambda CDM.
Cosmological problems are part of the problem. People don't understand their vacuum. So once you solve that,
I wouldn't quite say it's all on particle physics. There's a lot of interesting questions you can ask on the gravity side as well. What was I going to say? Whereas the cosmological constant fits the data now, very soon things are about to change. There are going to be things like Euclid, things like LSST that can probe nonlinear structure and things like this using lensing. And at this point, it's very important to have a few different viable models and to have differing predictions so you can actually utilize this data to test it. And this is one of the reasons why I think these theories are worth investigating.
So I thought these Kordensky and Leon Kordensky don't have any kind of non-normalization of just the original.
If you take the decoupling limit, there's So if you go to flat space, you get the non-renormalization, yes.
So you need something, if you want to say something about the cosmological acceleration,
you're in the fully covariant limit, yes, I agree. I don't know a lot about what the actual renormalizations for these things are, so I can't comment too much. I don't know if anyone's ever looked at it actually in the fully covariant, although I guess you'd expect. The hope would be you generate new terms which are irrelevant at some scale, but I don't. I'm not an expert on that. So in general relativity, you get these two potentials, the Newtonian potential and this thing psi, which tells you how much light is bent. And the way the breaking works is you get modifications of this of the equations which govern the field sourced by a non-relativistic object inside the object. These new terms are zero outside, so they're parameterized by two numbers. So the deviations in the Newtonian field are parameterized by this number epsilon 1. And so for this reason, inside non-relativistic objects, so not outside, will respond to gravity differently from general relativity. A priori, this thing can be as large as infinity, but it's bounded from below. It can't be bigger than minus 2/3. It can't be less than minus 2/3, and this is because you can't form stable stars if you go that small. I like to pause here for a second because this has actually got quite an amazing property, and that is that if epsilon 1 is positive, so for most of the parameter space, gravity actually gets weaker, and that's because this term here is typically negative if your density profile decreases outwards. This is actually quite an amazing thing because most theories of modified gravity, things like chameleons, other theories which aren't beyond Horndesky, they actually predict that gravity gets stronger. It's very hard to make gravity get weaker. But this theory does it. So it's very interesting because it opens up a new realm of possibilities for testing these theories using new probes that we couldn't use for other theories.
Solution stable? When you say gravity is getting weaker, it sounds like a ghost.
I think it's stable. I think it's a funny algebraic thing which comes out. Although I am looking at perturbations right now, so I might know more about that in a couple of months or so.
But so you're saying that outside you have the Weinstein mechanism, but somehow inside it's not.
Yes, and the reason is that these beyond Horndesky theories give you third spatial derivatives.
So this is just in beyond Horndesky.
It's only beyond Horndesky. If I turn that off, I don't get anything.
But then you can third space derivatives of going back to Matt's point. So as soon as we turn any dynamical feature, things would just happen.
There are no third time derivatives, so there's no...
Precisely. That's perfectly fine. First derivative, second derivative, and even all derivative combination is really, really bad. I can show you in one
okay.
lecture, we're just, you're going to have things blowing up in your face no matter what.
Okay,
and
that's... Okay. All right, that's something to think about.
So you're saying it's better unless you have like exponential developer.
Yeah, you're going to have your dispersion relation.
Yeah, I guess
right.
Yeah.
Okay. That's, yeah.
But there's
okay.
supposed to be something
generic or,
yeah.
or just
yeah.
generic.
Yeah, it's pretty generic.
Yeah.
Somebody must have.
Someone's there. People have looked at stability, so it guarantees freedom from the Ostrogradsky ghost. It doesn't guarantee you against Laplace instabilities and things like that. People have studied the stability of these theories cosmologically, and it's well known which branches are stable and which ones aren't. In terms of more general settings, that I don't know. So yeah, it's probably something to think about. Sorry, say that again.
The great study mechanism is producing a repulsive gravitational force.
Yes.
You can do that with a vector part.
You can. So that's true. Some of the tests, which I'm going to talk about later, can be used to test things like negative mass couplings to second metrics and vectors with negative charges and things like that. But in this case, it's very easy to satisfy those tests by tuning the masses, whereas here, it's these parameters. And I'll tell you why these parameters are very important in just a moment. But just to say, you also get different effects parameterized by a different parameter in the second metric potential, so you expect effects in relativistic systems as well. And this is unconstrained a priori, no one's ever looked at these parameters. Right, this is why these parameters are very important. If you take Bjorn-Hondesky theories, which are a very, very general class of modified gravity models, and you ask, what do these things do on cosmological scales? There are five free functions of time, or redshift, which parameterize these deviations for the entire class of theories. These parameters I'm talking about are related to three of them. So by using small-scale tests, you are able to constrain the effective field theory of dark energy, as people call it. I know someone's going to put their hand up and say it's not an effective field theory. I agree. In the traditional sense, this is what people call it, so I'm sticking to the same nomenclature. So things like testing weak lensing probes, combinations of these parameters. So for example, this is the speed of gravitons relative to the speed of light. This thing tells you about braiding terms. This thing tells you about how much beyond Hondesky terms you have in your action. So this is quite important because doing these small test scale tests can actually place cosmological constraints as well. Right, so now I get to motivate my talk, given that I've explained a bit about why I'm doing this and the sort of theories I'm talking about. So what I'm going to talk about is stellar structure, galactic rotation curve tests, galaxy cluster tests, and a new test of gravity, which I put out only this last year, using dwarf stars. How much time do I have, just so I know?
Half an hour,
okay, that should be fine. So, I should say some of this comes with a caveat. This is all very new. It's only around this time last year that people realized the mechanism was partially broken, so we've only just been able to start looking at some of these tests. And so for that reason, some of them are going to be more useful than others. Some of them, we're going to have looked at the predictions and we might not necessarily know what to do with the data yet. Although when I say this talk, I always have some, if you have any great ideas, please come and talk to me. And some of these we've been able to use to place brand new constraints on these theories. So I'll start with stellar structure, just because it's this is a historical progression. And it's also the same thing I spoke about 3 years ago with regards to a different theory of gravity here, so I thought it was quite fitting. So the main idea, stars are big balls of gas. They like to, they'd like to collapse under their own gravity, but they end up burning fuel or hydrogen in the center and reach some sort of equilibrium. So of course, if you change the theory of gravity, you change the burning rate. And so you alter properties like the temperature, the luminosity, the lifetime, things like that. The only equation that governs stars out of every single one, the four star structure equations, all of the reaction networks, the only one that changes in modified gravity is this one, the hydrostatic equilibrium equation. So this says, if I want to form an stable equilibrium configuration, the pressure and density, the mass, must satisfy this equation if I'm going to be able to do that. So all that happens is you get an extra term here. To take a concrete example, I'm going to talk about the theories where gravity gets weaker just because it's new and interesting. If you change that to stronger, everything just flips in the direction you'd expect it to. So if I make gravity weaker, of course, I don't have to work as hard to stop collapsing, so I don't have to burn as fast. I get stars which are dimmer, cooler, and live for longer. If I make gravity stronger, of course, you get the complete converse. So before you launch into solving 50 million complicated equations, you can get a good idea for what's going to happen by considering very simple models. And these are what people call polytropic stars. So it's an equation of state for the pressure in terms of the density given by this number n, which is what people call the polytropic index. So for main sequence star and very compact white dwarfs, n equals 3 is a good approximation. If you want to look at convective stars and high-mass brown dwarf stars, which I will talk about later, you need n equals 1.5. And for very low-mass brown dwarfs, n equals 1 is the number you want to look at. So if I change the theory of gravity, what's going to happen? There are two types of non-relativistic stars. There are those that are supported by gas pressure, which have this equation of state, and radiation pressure, which tend to be higher mass stars. So I need to look at this separately. But if I roughly scale all the quantities out, I find that if my star is supported by gas pressure, the luminosity scales like the fourth power of g. So low mass stars are very strong probes of the theory of gravity. They scale like g to the 4. High mass stars, which are radiation pressure supported, they're not as powerful probes. They only scale like g. So a picture paints 1,000 words. If you go ahead, do the calculations, do all the numerics, what you end up with is this. So what I'm plotting here is the ratio of how bright a star in these modified theories would be as a function of their mass. So this is a very strong deviation from general relativity, and you can see it's 20% lower. Here's a slightly weaker deviation. So epsilon 1's 0.1, and you get about 0.8 or so. So you can see we might hope to be able to probe these at some point. Of course, what I've used is a very simple model. If you want to somehow compare to data, you need to be a bit more realistic than this. So what I've played is the same game that I used to play with chameleons. So I've taken a publicly available stellar structure code, which is called MESA. I've implemented modified gravity equations. And this code does everything which I can't. It's got a consistent treatment of stellar structure. It includes physical processes like convection and things like that. We've used this in the past. So my collaborators at Penn and I, we've used this to compare with data in the past and get new constraints. So the hope is that at some point we'd be able to do this for these theories. So here is the plot which comes out of MESA. So what I'm plotting here is the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, temperature on the bottom and how bright the star is. So the black one's general relativity. And as you can see, if I change the theory of gravity, so 0.3, 0.5, which is a stronger modification, my star does in fact get dimmer. Although the interesting thing is this behavior seems to disappear on the red giant branch. Older stars aren't very good probes of these theories of gravity. Sorry? Oh, Z's the metallicity. So these ones, the black, red, and blue, are for a solar mass star and solar metallicity.
It evolves with age along the curve.
It does, yes.
Many stars for one curve.
This is one star per curve. Star. I am able to make isochrones. I have the ability to do that, but for the moment, Sorry?
There are two black curves.
There are, and I'm going to come on to that now. So one thing that you do when you play this game of fiddling around with stars in modified gravity, you have to be aware of other astrophysical degeneracies. And sometimes these help you, sometimes they don't, and you don't know until you go out and do it. So what I'm plotting here is another general relativity star with the same mass, but with a higher metallicity. So this black dashed curve here has Z equals 0.03. So this is post-solar metallicity. As you can see, there's a degeneracy along this part here. this star with a higher metallicity looks like a theory where you've got a solar mass, solar metallicity star, and just a different theory of gravity. But it changes, it doesn't go to the same curve in the red giant track. So is this going to help us or not? As I said at the start, we've only just been able to do this, so we're now starting to think about possible ways we can test this or whether or not it's possible. One thing we're thinking about is using, for example, fitting to globular clusters using different parts of this curve, so seeing if there's some sort of systematic offset between the metallicity of the clusters inferred using this part of the track and that. But as I said, this is something that we're still thinking about, so we're not able to use this to place constraints at the moment, although we do now have the tools to make predictions, realistic ones, for stars in these theories, so we're starting to pursue other avenues as well. Sorry, I should have done that before. This black dot shows you where the star is at solar age. So as I said, because the star's not burning as much fuel, it's going to live for a bit longer. So these stars are younger. Right, so let me talk about rotation curves a bit. Again, very, very, very simple physics. The circular velocity of objects orbiting galaxies just depends on the Newtonian potential. If I change the theory of gravity, I just change how this potential is related to the mass of the object, so I can look for new features and changes like that. So this is the curve you get out if you look at rotation curves in these theories. General relativity, this one here, if I make gravity weaker, the shape doesn't change so much, but what does change is the velocity slightly further out. We're starting to think about ways we can test this. So we were able to test chameleon theories using data from Manga and SDSS using tests like this. So we're starting to talk to people and think about this a bit. One thing we're thinking about is looking for...
Sorry, how are you doing this calculation? So
I'm...
Mass profile?
Oh, NFW. Sorry, I should have said. This is for an NFW profile for a Milky Way-like galaxy.
But we don't know it's going to be
no, so as again, this is just to see the size of the effect. What we typically do when we look at these tests is you'd fit all the parameters simultaneously and do some joint fits, which I will come back to in the next section.
But there should be a degeneracy between weakening gravity and changing the halo profile. If you just measure the rotation.
So you need some other sort of probe to compare it to as well, something like lensing. And I'll come back to that now. Yep.
In the standard model, the effect of lambda is a tiny rotation curve.
Yep.
Lambda produces a repulsive force like you have.
Yes.
So you're trying to mimic lambda.
Small
idea, right?
No.
Yeah, yes and no. So the way we mimic lambda is through the cosmological dynamics. On smaller scales, there really is an extra force which is either screened or not in this case. Well, one thing we're thinking about is looking at different probes of the rotation curve and looking for offsets there. But as I said, you need something else to break the degeneracy, so you need to look at something like lensing. And we're able to do that as well. I have a similar curve for how the lensing profile looks. I'm not going to include it here because I'm going to talk about something more interesting you can do using lensing. Niash, how am I doing for time?
You're good.
Oh, I'm good. I'm going too quickly. Okay. If you take the lensing curve for this, for the exact same galaxy, what you see is the lensing of light gets weaker, of course, because you're weakening gravity. And it gets weaker in a slightly different way. So you can predict this as a function of epsilon. We're hoping you can sort of compare the two. And people have started to do this for other theories as well. We haven't done it yet. We've done something slightly different. So far, these are the first two of the ones which we can't get constraints from at the moment, mainly because we're still understanding them and thinking about ways we can compare to data. The next two, we've actually been able to place constraints using this. So the part I'm going to talk about now is unpublished work. So I haven't put the paper out yet, but it should appear within the next couple of weeks. So whenever you look at galaxy cluster statistics, so groups of galaxies, you can probe their mass using two different methods. You can probe it using X-ray surface brightness. So this, of course, probes the baryonic physics, so it probes hydrostatic equilibrium. So you can define this quantity from the hydrostatic equilibrium equation, which is called the hydrostatic mass. And you can define this other quantity, this this thing called the lensing mass. So non-relativistic objects, the baryons, they respond to phi only. Lensing light responds to phi plus psi. So of course, in general relativity, you just have phi equals psi. So the lensing mass is the same thing as the hydrodynamical mass or hydrostatic mass. Now, of course, in modified gravity, this thing changes because both this equation is modified and this equation. This cares about epsilon 1, this cares about epsilon 1 and epsilon 2. So you end up with an extra term here, which depends on, if I choose an NFW profile, the scale radius, the scale density in epsilon 1 and epsilon 2. So it cares about your theory of gravity. And of course, if you then go out and measure these two things using different probes, so X-ray brightness and the lensing profile, any non-agreement, or in our case, agreement, probes the theory of gravity. So these are the results we're coming up with by doing this. We do a joint MCMC fit to both the NFW profile parameters and these parameters. So we've got the 95, 1 and 2 sigma contours. As you can see, these things agree with GR. They're centered on zero. But there is a bit of wiggle room. This stuff does fit the data. So we're using X-ray data from XMM Newton. And we're using the stack profile of clusters. And this beats things down like ellipticity and things like that, because these theories are very... Yeah, so these theories are very sensitive to the geometry of your source. And everything I'm talking about is for spherical symmetry. So what you can do is you can show that if you take the stacked profiles, you get something which looks very spherically symmetric. So we can beat it down that way. So there's a bit of width in the distribution. The numbers we're quoting look like this. So epsilon 1.
So I don't understand that. So I mean, different clusters have different masses. If you stack the X-ray profiles, then you don't have an average mass profile, because when the X-ray emission is nonlinear.
You're asking the wrong person, I'm afraid.
But this is not published yet, so there's some.
No, I'll email and ask. I know they've. I should know this because I've read their other papers carefully. That's the same people who I'm working on with this. They've done it for chameleon theories, and they're able to obtain constraints there. So I assume they know what they're doing. I'm purely on the theory side of this. So we're getting these two constraints here. We've got a constraint on epsilon 1, which is consistent with the lower bound set by stable stellar configurations. So epsilon 1 should be around 0.1 or so, let's say, or 1. Epsilon 2, this is the first constraint on epsilon 2, and currently the only constraint. So it provides an orthogonal direction to the effective field theory parameters. And one important thing to note is that because these things evolve as a function of time, the median redshift in our sample is 0.33. So these constraints apply not at redshift 0, but at higher redshift. And this is important because, of course, these functions evolve as a function of time. So previously, if you wanted to play a game where you constructed some model so that it did nothing throughout the history up to, say, z equals 0.5 and then suddenly took over at low redshift, this is a way of a new constraint which you can use to constrain those models. Right, now I'll come on to the fun part. Yes?
Sorry, I just want to ask a question. You might not have the answer, but what's the resolution in R that you get from weak lensing?
The resolution in?
How well are you resolving the shape of the halo?
I don't know the answer. You're asking the wrong person.
If you stack things, then you can, it could be a fraction of the other radius. But you have to stack it. The resolution is not the main problem, the error rate.
Have you investigated the collisions of clusters, bullet clusters, people fight to zero?
We have not, mainly because these theories are so difficult. It's very hard to simulate these things. It's very hard to go away from spherical symmetry and things like that. And also, you start with what's simplest. As I said, we've only just been able to do this. you always start with what's simplest and then start building up, and you have to decide whether it's worth it. And what I'm going to show you in a minute is actually I've been able to get very strong constraints on these theories without having to do that using a much simpler method. So for the moment, I'm not very motivated to do that. Okay, so this is a new test of gravity, which I realized could be done earlier last year. And that's using very low mass stars with mass less than 0.1 solar masses or so, what people call dwarf stars. It turns out the only reason we can do this is because of the amazing property that I talked about before, that gravity can get weaker in these theories. So these stars are perfect tests of modified gravity and perfect for theorists like me because they're very simple and they don't require a lot of numerics to predict their structure. So they're very chemically and structurally homogeneous, so I can use an equation of states and simple methods. This equation of states is very well known. People in the 50s were very interested in the properties of hydrogen at high pressures and high densities and in these stars. Turns out with these equations of states, polytropes are very good approximations. And unlike things like chameleons, which require sort of objects that people don't follow so much these days, Cepheids, there's a lot of interest in these low-mass stars because things like Kepler and future missions, they're looking at exoplanets, and at some point the line gets a bit blurred, so they're looking at very low-mass objects. Okay, so what I'm plotting here is the mass-radius relationship for dwarf stars. So very low masses, 10 to the minus 3, Jupiter's over there for comparison. I've got a very, very flat mass radius relationship. The radius of very low mass stars is approximately constant. Please bear in mind this is a log scale. So that's a brown dwarf. And for brown dwarfs, n equals 1 polytropes are very good approximations. If I go to higher mass.
Brown dwarf here?
Sorry?
Do you have a brown dwarf?
These, I believe, are exoplanets. So what I will come on to say later is that I don't claim constraints from brown dwarfs, but I do point out that they are very good probes of these theories. At some point, so brown dwarfs don't fuse hydrogen, they're very cold inert stars. At some point, as the mass gets bigger, the core gets denser, the core gets hotter, and so eventually I turn on hydrogen fusion. So these things are real stars in some sense, they're fusing hydrogen. And of course, at some point, you have to switch on, and so you get this point here, which is what people call the minimum mass for hydrogen burning. There is a minimum stellar mass you need in order to fuse hydrogen into helium.
What are these time scales there, 10 gigayears?
Where are we? Oh, so the radius, this radius plateau here is slightly sensitive to metallicity and cooling of the star, so how old the star is. So they plot it for slightly different models as an illustration.
So can I ask, so you said if n is 1, that means pressure causes density is square?
Yeah, so what's happening is the dominant contributions from Coulomb scattering.
Oh, okay.
So as you, it's the reason you get this tiny bump is that it's not quite 1, it's very, very close, so what people do is...
If there's a gas, a free electron, that would think if pressure causes density to the 5 thirds.
Yes, so that's what happens here. Okay. So this is really the switch on of that effect. So I'll start with brown dwarfs just because it's the more boring one. This radius plateau is given by a very simple calculation. It turns out you can calculate it, cares about the equation of states and things that depend on non-gravitational physics, so this doesn't change. And it depends on this structure constant here, and this you actually get from solving the stellar structure equations. So this cares about the theory of gravity. And there's the result there. So. This epsilon here is actually epsilon 1. If you take GR, the result you get here is 0.1. This is the radius plateau for a brown dwarf in general relativity. And this is it here, and as you can see, 10 to the minus 1's there. It's very close. If you take the theory of gravity, all you do is calculate this thing gamma, which is a bit of a calculation, but not too difficult. For value of epsilon 1. And so, of course, if I make gravity weaker, the radius gets larger. If I make gravity smaller, the radius gets smaller. And so if you were able to probe this mass-radius relation, and people are interested in these exoplanets, they do find a lot of brown dwarfs. There's a very active community working on this. I'm pointing out for the moment you could test the theory of gravity as well. You could probe these theories. Something that I've been very successful with is red dwarfs. So red dwarfs are these stars here. These are stars which...
Can you do it with Jupiter?
People have asked me that. So I did look into this when people started suggesting it. It seems that Jupiter's a bit more uncertain than some of these, so people aren't quite sure whether it's got a rocky core or not. They're not quite sure how the equation of state changes. So for the moment, I haven't.
But I mean, if we don't know it for Jupiter, we don't know it for this guy either.
Yeah, Jupiter has this funny issue where the thermal spectrum is off by what they expect, so they don't know about the cores. And I think this is a better approximation for, so Jupiter's more planetary. It's irradiated by the sun and things like that. So it's there are some degeneracies there. I am starting to look at Jupiter because it seems that what scared me off about these core issues are very minor things that people working on the spectrum of Jupiter are doing. So I need to think a bit more about that and other things. I'm going the right way. Okay, so red dwarfs are here. These are stars which are actively fusing hydrogen, and they're well described by this equation of state. And I'm going to use this thing here, so I'm able to predict this minimum hydrogen burning mass in the following way. So the idea is, if I make my theory weaker, I get a cooler core. It's not as hot, not as dense. And so this will lower the it raises the minimum mass for hydrogen burning. So of course, if I raise the mass for hydrogen burning, then at some point I'm going to be in tension with observations, because people have measured hydrogen burning stars with specific masses which have got reasonably tight error bars on them, and they agree with general relativity, and if I just keep going and raising this mass, my theory predicts these things should not be hydrogen burning. So I'm able to get a constraint like that. So again, it's a very similar calculation to the one I did before. The GR result is 0.08 solar masses to fuse hydrogen. This number here is set by proton burning, and this thing delta is another structure coefficient which comes from solving the cell structure equations. So all I needed from my input is the equation of state and my theory of gravity, and I have that. And if you do it, you find that it's an incredibly sensitive probe of this parameter epsilon 1. So if you recall when I was talking about main sequence stars, when I was talking about rotation curves, I was throwing in numbers like epsilon 1's 0.1, 0.8, 0.2. Orders of order 10 to the minus 1. This is telling me if I even change it by 10 to the minus 2, I raise the minimum hydrogen burning mass to 0.1 solar masses. It is a very strong probe of these theories. And so for this reason, I've been able to obtain what was actually the first constraint on these theories, and a very strong one at that, by just going through the literature looking for the smallest mass that I could find. The smallest mass object is this thing here. It's called GL886C. Please don't ask me what that means, because I don't know. And this thing has a mass of 0.09 solar masses plus or minus 0.0008. And so because this is such a strong function, I've been able to plug this number in and just read off the value of epsilon 1, which predicts this star shouldn't be burning hydrogen. And you get a very strong constraint. You get a number which is epsilon 1 is less than 0.027. So this is a...
Can I ask,
yes.
Method by which that mass is determined? Are you certain that it would be modified by the same multiplication?
Okay. So I believe they look for objects in binaries. And they use the binary method. Because remember, these are all nearby objects you're able to do. Yes. So you can ask some questions. So, for example, you could have issues with resolving these binaries. You could have things like that. My response to that is that this isn't one object. There are lots of objects with very similar masses in the same region, and this just happens to be the lowest one I could find. If you take the next highest mass or the next highest one, you get pretty much the same constraints.
And it's the usual principle that the lowest in any class is the one that's most likely to be measured incorrectly.
Oh, yeah.
given that strong constraint, is it be more convincing to have some constraint averaged over some sample?
I guess you could do that. There's a lot. I mean, there are some which actually have 0.08 in this number. The problem is the errors are slightly larger. But actually, the interesting thing is actually a brown dwarf and red, an exoplanet Facebook group that I was invited to join after I put this paper out. So we were discussing it on there a lot, and I think we've come to an agreement now that it's okay. Sorry, I didn't mean to do that yet. So this is a very, very strong constraint. And of course, it tells us two things. It tells us, one, that some of the previous probes we were looking at, things like rotation curves, things like lensing, things like stellar tests, might not be the best probe of these objects now. And this is one of the reasons why I haven't rushed to follow up on all these tests I was talking about earlier. It's because this strong constraint really does kill them off. Of course, the same can't be true for stronger gravity, because if you make gravity stronger, it's always going to be consistent with the GR value. So this method only probes theories of gravity which predict a weakening of GR. Stronger theories of gravity lower the minimum burning mass, so it's consistent.
Way, wouldn't you expect to find even lower mass things that are quite pretty
good? You would. The problem is I don't know how to turn that into a constraint. It seems that the absence of them is still consistent in both theories. You could make the argument that we just haven't observed them yet. And the other interesting thing is, of course, this is a very strong constraint again. You can use this constraint really to actually constrain how much deviations from GR you can get on cosmological scales, precisely because this is related to the functions appearing in what people call the EFT. How much time have I got left?
5 minutes.
Okay, that's good, because I'm finished. So I'm just going to summarize and finish there. So modified gravity is worth exploring. You get new theories of dark energy. There's a possibility of self-acceleration. If you want to test general relativity, you need it. You have to have competing theories. Otherwise, you've got no way of saying how well your theory agrees with GR, you know, if it's consistent. And you can satisfy solar system tests using screening mechanisms, so these theories are viable. In this talk, I talked about using astrophysics to test these theories. One potential probe that I talk about was non-relativistic stars. there you should see some effects, but it turns out there's a lot of degeneracy, so we need to think about that a bit. Rotation curves, again, you see effects, but you need to think about the degeneracies and having something else to compare these curves to. We've been able to do something similar for this for clusters, so we've been able to get some new constraints, but it turns out they're weaker. So historically, I put this paper out first. But you do get some new constraints. But you get the first constraint on epsilon 2, so you're able to probe a different region of parameter space in the effective field theory. And finally, low-mass stars, in particular, the minimum mass for hydrogen burning in red dwarfs, are a new and very, very sensitive probe of these theories, and they give us the strongest bounds so far. So I will stop there and say thank you for your attention.
Before I take questions, as I said, Jeremy, we're having dinner, about lunch now, after talk. We're going to have the dinner with Jeremy downstairs at the bistro at 5:30, and Jeremy's going to be here through Thursday, his office is 374. Okay, right now.
Just to continue, so if you're looking for the lowest accurate mass for a red dwarf, why can't you look for the highest reliable mass for a brown dwarf and get two-sided?
But you don't. It's still consistent though. You don't. I guess it's a matter of opinion in that.
Why? You would have to burn hydrogen.
Oh, I see. Yes, that could. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes.
I mean, there is a brown dwarf there. I don't know how many brown dwarfs there are.
That's what put me off. So if you read the paper that I read, I essentially say that I don't claim any constraints from brown dwarfs, mainly because there aren't. There's only a few of them measured in that range. I guess you could do that. It's probably worth it, actually, yeah.
Max, so these parameters, epsilon 1 and epsilon 2,
yep.
Is it too complicated to explain where in the fundamental Lagrangian for this beyond Bernetsky theory what they translated to? Are there really only two free parameters in that?
No. So I've stopped showing that, and I've started showing these.
Yeah.
Instead, mainly because this is what people who work. This is it.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is.
What's alpha B and alpha H?
Okay. So this is what people in modified gravity think about rather than the fundamental action. So let me give you two examples. The first one is what people call the quartic Galileon, which I guess you guys are familiar with. If I take the quartic Galileon and I expand phi of tr is some phi zero of t, so the cosmological value, plus some phi of r, so the locally sourced value, epsilon one equals epsilon two, which is phi zero over lambda to the four, where this is the coupling scale which appears in the quartic Lagrangian. In terms of the fundamental Lagrangian, I could have, for example, the beyond Horndesky term. So the beyond Horndesky term, the simplest thing I can write down is, again, the quartic Galileon. So L would look something like x times box phi squared minus grad mu phi squared, dot, dot, dot. If you take the equations of motion for this cosmologically, perturb them, and say, how do they affect, for example, the growth of structure, this thing will always introduce some time evolution, which is given by some alpha h of t, where alpha h is related to these three functions there. So I could put some function there, and alpha would just be related to that. Similarly, if I take a term that looks like the Horndesky quartic Lagrangian, so can people see over here, by the way? You can't?
I can.
Right, so if I take the quartic in Horndesky, which looks like some where x is d phi squared, say, then this thing predicts a differing speed of gravitons relative to the speed of light. And so ct squared will be related to this function here. So it's really just a different parameterization of the functions that appear in the Lagrangian, mainly because what you put in the Lagrangian might not be most relevant for cosmology. It turns out it's different combinations of these parameters. And again, alpha b is the same thing. It tells you how much kinetic braiding you've got, so it responds to terms. It responds to terms which look like this in higher order. So if you take all of these things, calculate them in linear cosmology, combine them together, you'll find that only five combinations are relevant.
A question? John?
So getting back to the issue of the cosmological type is parallel and accelerating universe probabilities in cosmology. The equation state W from Planck 2015, W is minus 1.003 something plus or minus. So as the experiments get better, you get minus 1.0000 and so on. So you're having to limit this to get the best fit of the data.
Well, the best fit depends on the model you assume. So if you throw in different models, you may very well find those constraints go down a bit. And these things, actually, they're able to do that. So if you take these theories and you just solve them cosmologically, what you get is De Sitter space. You get a pure De Sitter solution with a cosmological constant which can be related back to... Sorry?
Three more parameters.
That's true, yes.
And that's one other point. Regarding the red dwarfs and so on, in order to fit the solar system data, there's a small constraint on the epsilon. The Bechstein mechanism has to screen.
Yes.
So the star like the sun, 0.1 mass of the sun, is still a weak gravity system inside. So you expect to have a very strong constraint.
You actually don't get a very strong constraint precisely because this thing's so big. If it's the Weinstein radius only goes like the mass to the third, so it's a very weak function of mass. This is for a solar mass star, but if I say, well, what about a brown dwarf or a red dwarf star? This number's not going to change a lot. It's going to change by a factor of 10 to the third. It's precisely because it looks like general relativity in the solar system, you just don't get a very strong constraint.
Nothing surprising happening.
Well, if this picture was reversed, so if it was unscreened outside and screened inside, then yes, I wouldn't need to do any of this. I could get a constraint straight off the bat because all the PPN parameters would be screwed up. But in this case, it's testing gravity inside sources is a lot more difficult than testing outside, precisely because you've got these degeneracies and precisely because you have to look at ways of breaking them.
So I have a comment. Are there any other questions? No, so I have a comment and a question. I think this point that Lewis brought up is a very important one. I mean, if these have third order derivatives, that all the third order derivatives are stable, then of course there's a much more study.
Yeah. Interesting.
So and the other thing, if you go back to your definition of these epsilon 1 and 2.
Yep.
Either one. If you go back to where they appear, or is that one more? Okay, good. So if you look at this, where the R is, I guess what I was worried about is that you have second derivatives there, and so how do they alter the hydrostatic equilibrium? Do you have that?
It will, yes. It'll be the same thing. not too far. It will appear there.
Right, that's the one. Okay, so let's say I want to integrate this to find the pressure. Okay, I have rho times the second derivative of mass, which is the first derivative of density, right?
Yes.
So it's d rho by dr.
So it looks like rho plus rho prime in.
Yeah, I guess what I was worried about is that if you have inhomogeneities, then they're going to have large derivatives.
Don't know. These theories are so complicated that we cannot solve for them outside of spherical symmetry. So within homogeneities, I have no intuition for what will happen.
Yeah. Okay, so I guess it's not as bad. Yeah. Okay, that's fine. Good. Thank you. If no other questions, then thanks, Jeremy, again.